Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome today to the Italian Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ellen Nirenberg from Wesleyan University. I'm here today with Sergio Rigoletto, a professor of Italian and Film Studies at the University of Oregon. Professor Rigoletto is the author of the recently published study entitled, in Italian, Le norme traviate, saggi sul genere e sulla sessualità nel cinema e nella televisione italiana. Translated into English, though the book is in Italian, Overturned Norms. I think we're going to come back to the title. Essays on gender and sexuality in Italian cinema and television. So that's the subject of Sergio Rigoletto's book. It is the first to be published in a series edited by Marco Dalla Gassa and Federico Zecca for Meltemi Publishers in Italy. Sergio Rigoletto's study consists of a critical introduction followed by six chapters that explore the visualization of queer characters and queer thematics in Italian popular cinema and television since about the middle of the 20th century. While the study follows a more or less chronological order, I think the author nonetheless eschews some of the historical inevitabilities that such a chronology tends to imply, and we may be able to get him to elucidate on that point in our conversation today. Beginning with the Commedia all'Italiana, Sergio Rigoletto begins to ask questions about queer characters in the background and offers a reading of, among other texts, Federico Fellini's 1960 La Dolce Vita. This is followed by examinations of what we might call a panic about masculinity in 1970s cinema. Subsequent chapters dedicated to texts like Fezzano Spetek's Le Fate Ignoranti and Luca Guadagnino's Call Me By Your Name make clear that popular cinema is one of the primary objects of study. But these chapters are also accompanied by some dedicated to lesser-known television texts and documentary cinema. The book is written in Italian and published in Italy, something else I think we'll be able to discuss today. Welcome, Sergio Rigoletto, to the Italian Studies channel on the New Books Network.
Hello, Ellen, and thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I want to start immediately with the title of your text, Le norme traviate. Could you, I don't know how pleasing my translation was of the overturned norms, but I was wondering if you could talk about that and the rationale or the reasoning behind the title.
Yes. So yeah, your translation was great. I guess it's the meaning would be to append norms is something like to make visible something that is supposed to remain invisible, to mark something that is supposed to be unmarked and transparent. And the norms I write about are, you know, sexual and gender norms. And you mentioned Italian-style comedy I write about in the book. This is really like the genesis of the project. How I came to become interested in this category, the norm, and this has something to do with my interest in this particular kind of comedy that was very prominent and popular between the 50s and 60s. So these are the years of the economic miracle. It's a period when Italy is going through a very intense process of modernization and industrialization. And basically, I became fascinated with the central figure of these comedies, the Italiano Medio, which in English would be the Italian everyman. This is a strange kind of figure. It's an ordinary Italian, an average Italian. But it's not like someone, let's say, James Stewart, right? That would be the Hollywood equivalent, the everyday all-American. The Italian everyman of this comedy is more like a hero and an anti-hero. You know, someone who's very ordinary, good-natured, a kind of family man, but he's also, you know, self-centered, ridiculous, at times even morally repulsive. So I was reading a lot about this figure, and as I was reading all these books, I would see all these repeated attempts to describe this figure with lots of adjectives, analysis, examples. And I realized that there was something that was never said, which was actually the most defining identity marker of this character. And that is his heterosexuality. And that's really the starting question of the book. How can an identity marker be so pervasive and yet become so transparent, so invisible, to the point that it's never really acknowledged as such? So that's how I became interested in the category of norm, which is what the book is about. It's about the gender and sexual norms and how they shape really the imaginaries, the collective imaginaries of Italian cinema and television between the 50s and the 21st century. And here, you know, heterosexuality, in particular male heterosexuality, is the central norm I focus on, especially in the first half of the book. Perhaps I should say what I mean by norm. I mean two things. Norm as rule, as a law, what basically sets what is wrong and what is right. But the norm is also a habit. So I reflect on the norm as a convention, as something that is repeatedly shown and affirmed, as something that acquires authority precisely through this process of repeated affirmation. And, you know, in the first half of the book, I examine how Italian cinema constructs for its audience this kind of collective sense of identity, so this sense of who we are. And this we, this us, is of course the Italian people. But it's not just a national community. This first person plural is also about those who are understood to have the right to be within society, within the boundaries of the normal. So the book is a study about the construction of these boundaries of the normal, of normal society, as they appear on Italian screens.
Thank you for that. That's so useful. And it seems that the tools by which the normative, the normal, what is permitted, as you say, to be seen as conventional, seems to track with the development of telecommunications. So I was wondering if you could say, if that makes any sense to say that it, in the first half of the book, you're talking about cinema before shifting really to television. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what that means within the codes and contexts of Italian cinema at this time. I mean, if you want to, of cinema, perhaps, as opposed to television at this time.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the first half of the book is about the second half of the 20th century, from the 50s onwards. And that's a time when cinema, the big screen, seems to really matter in Italy, as not just as a technology, but also as a collective cultural experience. As a way for a society to come together and, you know, to experience something, certain emotions, also to reflect on themselves. And I start on the 50s and 60s, so that's the golden age of Italian cinema, because, you know, I think it's a fascinating period. It's a period in which Italians, after the fall of fascism, after the end of World War II, are basically working out who they are. And Italian cinema plays a major role in this process. These are the years in which, after the trauma of the fascist dictatorship, Italian society is trying to find itself again, in a sense. So I became interested in this process, and I approached it as a question, right? Who do Italians want to be during these years, and how do they mark the defining boundaries of their collective identity? And of course, you know, part of that process of cultural representation has to do not just with tracing the boundaries of this us, our community, but also, you know, unfortunately, pointing the finger to those who are felt to be threats to this, to the majority, to the lifestyle of the majority, to their values. And I would say for most of the second half of the 20th century, these threats are usually homosexuals. They're usually sexually active women. Foreigners or racialized others. So I try to make visible and to make sense of these dynamics of exclusion and of construction of a sense of collective self.
Right, the greater we, as yeah. I have also heard it referred to, in establishing the parameters or the boundaries of a set of common mores, of precepts that are internalized, and the ejecting from that sort of that centric position, queer subjects. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about, for example, two of the texts that you're very interested in, Il Sorpasso di Norisi, and also known as The Easy Life, which is often seen as a companion piece, if only historically, to La Dolce Vita, The Sweet Life of Federico Fellini, which are two texts I'm, we'll get back to the again, the popular or the the well-known aspect of the text in a moment, but I was wondering if you could map out some of those readings with regard to these specific two texts.
Yeah, so, and I start the book with these two films. They are two canonical Italian films in the sense that if you know a bit about Italian cinema, you have watched these films. La Dolce Vita, made by Federico Fellini, one of the most famous auteurs. It's also a multilingual film with an international cast. Amazing actors and actresses like Marcello Mastroianni, Emma Anouk, Anita Ekberg. Like all these canonical films, after a few years, after a few decades, the scholars write about them, a certain kind of homogeneous narrative gets, let's say, written about them. So I became interested in how this film, spends very little time to shed light on kind of marginal characters, identified more or less as drag queens or homosexuals. And I was trying to make visible how the film really made use of them to indicate a certain path of salvation or damnation to the central character of the film. That is the character played by Marcello Mastroianni. And the two paths are, one family life, salvation, and the other one is corruption, debauchery, decadence. This is something they said about the film. What is not said is that homosexuality, the danger of homosexuality, plays a major role in this the second path that the film kind of explores. The other film is Sorpasso. In Italy, it's a very famous film. The ordinary Italians know very well, also because it's shown on TV very often. Perhaps in the US, it hasn't quite made it into the international film canon. It is very well known in continental Europe. And I was interested in writing about this film as a body film, okay, which is really like an Anglo-American category. So there would be, the road movies are body films because they usually focus on two friends, two male friends, unless it's a romantic story. This is not a way in which these films had been discussed in Italy, at least. I wrote about this friendship, which is also very homoerotically charged friendship, also one that seems obsessed with the danger of homosexuality. The film is about these two friends being so intimate, connected, but at the same time constantly talking about the real homosexuals. So that seemed to me an exemplary film to think about the demarcation of these boundaries, indicating who might threat outside these boundaries the stability of this us, this collective sense.
Fantastic. It's so interesting. I'm interested by a couple of things. There seems to be you've referred to the international or the foreign threats coming from without to challenge Italian social norms and mores beginning in the mid-century, and it's interesting that there's a sort of a double. Well, there are multiple transnational lines that are traveling through your study. So there's the transnational queer studies line. There's the transnational flow of tourism, of tourists back and forth between different languages as they are present in Italy, as they live in Italy, as they also have, you know, leave a mark in Italy too, that beginning with probably before the Grand Tour from the 19th century, but the mark that's left behind on the culture of arrival, I guess I'll call it. So there's also the other, one of the things about the transnational aspects of queer studies that I thought might be interesting to talk about is the sometimes temporal disconnections between things that are happening in one location and in one language, and then in another as they get translated, carried over, interpreted, and incorporated into academic subdisciplines. I was wondering if you would talk about that, the temporalities of translation and the flows, I guess I'll call it, from one area to another, and as that might be contextualized in your project.
Yes, so I guess we are also talking about this kind of dialogue that I proposed in my book between these Italian films and TV series and mainly Anglo-American critical theory, also a kind of politicized critical theory. And it's something, I guess, that's a bit to do with my autobiography, where life has taken me. You know, I grew up in southern Italy and then moved in my 20s to London for graduate school and then eventually to the US. You know, this transnational trajectory has had an impact on my identity as a scholar, my way of thinking, the kind of books I read. I guess we're also talking about a sort of national film media canon, right? The book is about Italian cinema and Italian television. So even if we're talking about transnational trajectories, the nation features in a major way in this project. And I guess I'm saying this because it's precisely this kind of transnational journey of my career as a scholar that has heightened a certain awareness of the national culture I come from, and the cultural problems they are attached to that. You know, as I was saying, I was trying to create a dialogue between a particular strand of critical theory in the Anglo-American Academy and Italian films and television. And this kind of critical theory is not just gender and queer theory, but also that theory that has come out of the UK, the so-called cultural studies. And this dialogue, I think, would have been difficult to create if, you know, I had studied and worked only in Italy. I was trying to resist. I'm trying to read something that might be behind your question. I was trying to resist what is sometimes kind of imperialistic tendency or kind of authority in Anglo-American scholarship, even in the most transformative kind of criticism. So a lot of the dialogue that I was trying to establish between Italy and Anglo-American scholarship has been informed by my anecdotal experience and exchange with scholars from North Europe and North America. So a certain way of understanding not just Italy, but Southern cultures with regard to gender and sexuality.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Well, actually, if I could, let's stay here for a second, because the questions that I mean, this is not reduced. Well, that's a value-laden term. This does not owe only to an autobiographical trajectory. I mean, those trajectories have also been formed by sociological trends in terms of available positions in universities and all sorts of things, right? So that the notion of leaving Italy to do Italian cultural studies is really, it's a rich vein to tap. You know, I don't want to talk about all those metaphors about depleting veins and mining things, but I think we don't necessarily think enough about the ways in which departing from one culture and going to another enables an interrogation, a challenging of certain precepts that could be only salutary to the original text or the text of departure, as I try to get my students to think of it, not necessarily the original text or the resource text, but one can only arrive at certain questions if certain questions become visible. So it's about that visibility, right? You have to see it to be it. And there is a certain activist strain to what you are doing. And I wondered if you could talk about that. I mean, it's not something that is only learned through Anglo-American criticism or Anglo-American institutions of higher learning in those academic settings, right? So I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that, about the kinds of questions that become visible when you are exposed to different settings in which those questions emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up as a scholar, as a young scholar, at a different time than the one we currently inhabit, where, you know, the kind of transnational global transfers of knowledge you're referring to are kind of more universally available. So it's true, when we start, certain orientations for our thinking, for our research, already present themselves as more likely than others. So, you know, this transnational journey and these transnational dialogues that are in the book are not, cannot be just choices, right? My choice. Yeah, something to do with, you know, the state of the Italian Academy in the 90s, when, you know, I was interested in gender studies. And at that time, it was difficult to find what I was interested in, a kind of school that placed an intense, robust conversation question on genders, gender with sexuality and class and race. So in search of that dialogue, I left for the UK. You know, I'm not saying that this, what we call intersectional conversations were not happening in Italy in the 90s. I, Sergio Rigoletto, could not see them. So I had to go to the UK. And over there, I studied with Lynn Segal. So I'm talking about, so Birkbeck College, a certain socialist tradition of feminist scholarship and feminist theory that was central to my academic education as well as my political education. So there was a kind of scholarship, a kind of school of thought that could not separate an analysis of things such as gender and sexuality from a serious commitment to, you know, a fight for social justice. So class, ethnicity, race were as important as question of gender and sexuality. That's the what I was reading in the books that were given to me in graduate school, and that's what I was seeing the lectures that I was listening to. My book obviously privileges gender and sexuality. I think, you know, I've done my best to acknowledge the value of certain media experience that are accessible to lots of people, okay? And here I'm bringing the question of class in. I'm not trying to make a populistic argument. I'm just trying to highlight the importance of, for us, scholars of media cultures, not to shy away from, you know, what has been described for a very long time, at least, you know, when I was undergraduate, as vulgar, as not deserving scholarly attention. And that's, you know, the lesson I learned from British cultural studies. So the idea that, you know, it's in mainstream culture, it's in popular film culture, that the most insidious, toxic aspects of our culture can be engaged, can be unpacked and resisted.
Yeah, that's so helpful to hear you talk about that. And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, yours is the first book published in this series, right? Can you confirm that?
That is true.
So I actually wondered if you could sort of turn around and look where you came from in that regard. So our listeners should know that this is the first book that you've published in the Italian language, following many other publications in English. I mean, it's worth saying that had you wanted to publish this study in English, it would have been received by a certain public, read by certain people. And I was hoping you could talk about the choices that guided you to decide to work in Italian right now, and talk about the reception of this book on gender and sexuality in 2020, 2021, Italy, where it's been published and is available?
Yeah, I've been writing on Italian cinema and television for, let's say, 15, 20 years. So, you know, I've been working in the UK, in the US. And because of this, I've been writing and publishing almost exclusively in the English language, which is something that, you know, entails certain advantages if you want your books or your essays to be read by more people. This book, I think, came at a time when I felt it was important to write in Italian. You know, it wasn't just a way of reconnecting with my mother tongue. That's been very important, by the way. The experience of finding yourself, finding that language that was part of yourself during the first half of your life, it's an experience, even a political experience, that I value very much. But for sure, you know, I was, in writing a book in Italian, I was hoping to connect with a certain kind of readership that is, you know, robustly interpolated by this book, right? It's on Italian cinema and television. So I wanted to write also, or primarily, for Italian readers who might not necessarily, you know, read English language books. You know, this is a time when, in Europe, especially in non-English language countries, in the universities, there is a kind of process that they call internationalization. That means this push to write in English more and more. It's a way, of course, of making your publication more available. It's also a shame, right? Because linguistically is a way of conforming, or, you know, trying to find one language to share, you know, certain conversation meaning, but also losing something of our, not just linguistic baggage, also our cultural baggage. So very, I don't know, nostalgically maybe, I was trying to go for something that is perhaps has become a bit more anachronistic, that is, you know, writing in Italian.
Sergio, it's so interesting that you should say that, because on the other hand, it strikes me as much more of a vanguard position to be in, to be the lead book in a series for a press, Melteni, right? That I'm wondering if we wanted to historicize that. It's not so much nostalgic as it is, there is now a reading public in Italy for a press to be able to publish a book for. I'm not saying that there haven't been reading publics previously, but one does need to make the case to a publisher that there will be a reading public that will in fact buy books, right? So it's about historicizing that moment. And you get at this, I wondered if you had any response to what I just said, that's not so much nostalgic as it is about the distance traveled between the 1990s, when you looked around and you didn't see what you wanted to study, and are now able to, in fact, if we wanted to characterize it this way, find a market for the very subjects that you want to talk about.
Yeah, in a way, it's true what you say. I think, you know, in Italy, in the publishing industry, in the academic book market, we are seeing, I guess, a kind of renaissance or heightened interest in a certain kind of potentially political academic publications that take very seriously questions of class and gender and sexuality. at different levels, you know, in sociology, in media, and so on. And of course, you know, in relation to gender, there is a very robust and long tradition of feminist scholarship. But I think, you know, for sure the number of courses that we see in Italian universities that focus on question of gender and sexuality have increased in a way that I would have never expected in the, you know, in the 90s when I was studying. You know, we shouldn't forget, you know, very vibrant publishing market in Italy, especially for film and television. I think, you know, my book found an audience and a publisher also because of that. There is already a lot going on in Italy. For sure, you know, interest in these conversations between with other context.
Right. What I wanted to say is certainly the focus and the, as you say, the rich bibliography of scholarly work that's been done on popular cinema, for example, in Italy is, I mean, it's really, as I say, been a very rich line of inquiry for some time. However, it's also worth saying that those studies of media or popular cinema or popular television haven't always focused on gender and sexuality. So that's the more intersectional aspect of your study that I think is so, so valuable to us. I wondered, you know, again, in historicizing the moment in which this book appears, it seems really important to me to also talk about the ways in which Italian television as an audiovisual text and product have traveled out along those, you know, digital video on demand circuits. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, I mean, could you talk a little bit about how in your introduction you characterize, for example, the character of Spadino in Suburra, and to mark that as a very particular moment in Italian television and media history. I think his openness, his deliberate avowedness of his queerness.
Yeah. In the book, I have two chapters on television. One is on the first lesbian-themed TV film commissioned by the Italian broadcaster Rai. And the second case study is really Suburra, as you say. This is the first Italian Netflix series, so the first TV series commissioned by Netflix. It's also the first Italian TV series whose central character could be read as homosexual. Or at least, you know, the first TV series that openly acknowledges this issue and makes it an important part of the story. And that's the...
And doesn't kill off the queer character.
That's very true.
He doesn't have to pay with his life for being, as he says, io so frocio. He doesn't have to pay for that.
Absolutely. That's a major difference from other TV series, Italian TV series that we had seen on Netflix, like Gomorra, for example.
They killed Salvatore Conte right off, didn't they? Once they uncovered his bisexuality.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, about Suburra, I was interested in this convergence, you know, the first Netflix TV series and Italian TV series, and also the first that would focus on homosexual character. So I was trying to think, how does Netflix and Netflix Italy get to this point? And should this, step forward just be celebrated, or shall we see what the terms and conditions of this newly found visibility for a queer characters would be. I try not to be too optimistic and to celebrate too much, but to be practical, to think about what video on demand services like Netflix are, right? They're commercial enterprises. If they think that a lot of people are interested in certain kind of stories, then they would put the money to make them. And Suburra arrives on Netflix at a time in which Netflix, I think, has already tested on a global scale with its subscribers the appeal of certain stories focusing somehow more or less on LGBT characters. I think that might be interested for viewers interested in TV series to see what changes from Gomorra, that's the other famous Italian TV series, to Suburra. Like a TV series like Gomorra seems less interested in making these references to queerness too explicit or to give them a name. And yet, very slowly Netflix realizes by paying attention to what fans write about online that there is an interest in this kind of stories. And this is something that Dana Renga has written about very eloquently in her book, Sympathetic Perpetrators. So I read this TV series, yes, as a kind of thermometer of where Italian screen culture is, but also as a thermometer of a certain kind of globalized media experience that Netflix produces.
So absolutely, and that's great. That's a great overview of the television market. I want to take a step to the side because of the parallel way in which you're treating both television and cinema, and ask you to do the same thing for two film texts that you just did for the two television texts, Gomorra and Suburra, to talk about instead Le Fate Ignoranti and then Call Me By Your Name. I'm sure that listeners would like to hear you talk especially about your reading of Call Me By Your Name.
So shall I start with that? Yeah, let's start with Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, let's start with Call Me By Your Name. I could answer my own question and say that there's the same historical development, if you like. Yeah. I know that sometimes you're less interested in the teleology of certain historical arguments, but it is the case that Ospetek's film does precede Guadagnino's by some 15 years and makes possible certain films by Guadagnino as a result, I think. So we could just cut to the chase with Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, I see what you were asking. The Ignorant Fairies, the film by Ospetek, reflects on this very important moment in Italian popular culture, film culture, a time in which queerness is becoming normalized at the cinema. What I've described earlier on about television with Suburra happens, 15 years earlier on the big screen. And of course, it's a certain kind of queerness that is linked to a male vision and male stories that, find more space than other stories. But the Ospetek film is still, even though it's built on a male vision, male gay director, spends lots of time actually to reflect about friendship between women, the central character played by Margarita Bui, and gay men. So I write about the political value of that encounter between feminism in a way and gay liberation. And as he gets played out in the early 2000s,
And as a sort of coming out story held hostage in a way by the, spoiler alert, death of Margarita Bui's husband and her posthumous to him anyway, discovery of his gayness and her relationship, her friendship that then develops with his male lover. So that's what you've just described. And then, about 15 years later, right? Luca Guadagnino makes and releases Call Me By Your Name, an English language film that is, however, set somewhere in the vague recesses of the North, not exactly precise, right?
Yeah, somewhere in Northern Italy. so it's a film that got lots of coverage, right? It's a film that I teach, and I've rarely seen a film that triggers such an intense emotional response in my students, no matter whether they are LGBT or not. I guess, I've started thinking about this film to make sense of this strong emotional impact I have seen by talking to people. The starting point of my thinking about this film is, I like wasting time reading reviews of the films I like. Okay, I read lots of them. And when Call Me By Your Name came out, I noticed that, critics, journalists were repeating all the time this thing. They were saying, this is a film that has at the center a love story between two men, but it's really a universal story. So I became fascinated with this double kind of rhetorical gesture, right? This way of acknowledging the particularity of the story, being a homosexual love story, but then, reducing it to a level of irrelevance. I ask, why do people keep on saying this? Why do they say it now? Right? What's the value of calling a queer love story or a gay love story a universal story in 2018-17? That's when it came out. I tried to reflect on how the film tries to tell a kind of universal story. And by that, I mean how the film really tries hard to tell a fantasy of a world in which the love between a man and another man is not a problem. It's not seen as a problem. And I take that really seriously. I see how the film, at the level of the story, but also aesthetically, tries to tell this kind of story, but also how the film fails in the pursuit of this fantasy. There is something very dark in the film, especially in the second half of the film. Some kind of ghost from the past that haunt this story. And also, I was interested in how the film kind of tricks us, right? It makes us believe that the film, that the story does not end well because it is trying to tell a coming-of-age story. And coming-of-age stories about first love are doomed to end, right? But, if we look closely, the film does not end well because some ghosts are still lingering. Some ghosts that haunt the experience of homosexual desire in the film. So, you know, I try to show that even though Call Me By Your Name is set in the 80s, it's actually a film about the present. And that this should be taken very, very seriously. It's true that it's a film set in the 80s, and that's, as everybody probably knows, a very painful decade for homosexuals and all homosexuals, AIDS, and all the fear and destruction that epidemic brought. And the film tries to say something about that period, not in an obvious way. Or to put it another way, tries to say something about the relation between this painful past, the 80s, and this present, this time that we inhabit, that seems so different, right? That's what we keep on hearing, that now we live in a post-gay time of kind of equality legislations and queer-friendly Netflix series. But the film maybe is trying to tell us something different.
And it's trying to tell us something different all the way up to its very conclusion, isn't it? So you're talking about time. Would you care to say a few words about that extraordinary rupture? It's either an extraordinary rupture of time or an extraordinary suturing of time. I haven't really decided which. Mm-hmm. At the very end, as Elio looks into the fire and we look at Elio, we gaze upon Elio, gazing and thinking. I wondered if you could say something about time and temporality there.
Yeah, it's such a powerful emotional moment, right? We stay for, I think, around 3 minutes with him, the camera still looking at him crying in front of the fire. You know, I think, you know, what makes that moment especially heartbreaking, it's not just the, you know, the end of the love story. You know, that's my opinion. What I try to argue in the film, what makes it heartbreaking is the fact that the film, in very subtle ways, has shown to this teenager that the path to being different, and being different in the film might be perhaps becoming gay or becoming heterosexual, that path is not viable. It's too risky, too dangerous. So I think that's what we are confronting in that moment. That moment when, you know, I guess queer teenagers of a certain generation, or even these days, is something they can identify with. When, you know, it seems like there are no alternatives to the one inevitable path that society places in front of us.
You know, it's interesting because you started actually in talking about le norme traviate, about the upending of norms and also the rendering visible of certain possibilities. And this is about not only, the film doesn't so much foreclose those possibilities as shine a light on that foreclosure. And so in a way, I'm really grateful for the way that you both historicize it and contextualize it, because on the one hand, you have queer kids who are benefiting from the it gets better mm-hmm. movement. And the glee and the post-glee world where being a queer kid is, you know, not marginal at all, but rather in some ways quite celebrated. And at the same time, the ghosts that you call it that come back, whether it's heartbreak or whether it's specifically the queer heartbreak of AIDS in the 1980s that the film so deftly accomplishes, and speaking of deftness, that you accomplish in what is really a tour de force reading of that film, for which I thank you. That's at the end of your book, the reading of Call Me By Your Name. And we are approaching the end of our time today. And so I'd like to conclude my conversation with Sergio Rigoletto, who has been talking with us about his wonderful new study, Le Norme Traviate. It's in Italian, published by an Italian publishing house, Melteni. And we always end, Sergio Rigoletto, inviting our guests to tell us about what they're working on currently. And so I am here to ask you that question. What are you currently working on?
I'm working on two books. One is on this amazing, unforgettable film actress and theater actress called Anna Magnani. And I'm also writing another book on the kind of queer media cultures and media activism in the Mediterranean and in the Global South.
That's what an interesting outgrowth from Le Norme Traviate. I can see how the intersectional approach that you bring to bear on your subject there is informing and entailing this new project. Sergio Rigoletto from the University of Oregon has been talking with us about Le Norme Traviate. We are very grateful, and we are signing off on today's discussion from the Italian Studies Channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ellen Nirenberg. Thank you so much for listening.